from the High Center Studios of Messiah College, where we honor the legacy of freedom seekers here in Grantham, Pennsylvania. This is the Wave Improvement Leads Home podcast, a bi-weekly discussion dedicated to American history, historical thinking, and the role of history in our everyday lives. And now, here's your host, author and award-winning historian, John Fia.
Thank you, Drew, and welcome to episode 58 of the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast. We are glad that you've joined us. Our guest today is Richard Bell, a professor of early American history at the University of Maryland. Bell is the author of Stolen, Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. Stolen is a gripping and true story of five boys who were kidnapped in Philadelphia and smuggled into slavery in the Deep South, and their daring attempt to escape and bring their captors to justice. It is a wonderful piece of historical writing that merges deep scholarship, careful research, and captivating storytelling. I think you are going to enjoy this interview. But before we get to Richard Bell, let me tell you how you can connect with our work here. The Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast is a member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. When you get a chance, head over to recordedhistory.net to check out some of our fellow network podcasts. The Way of Improvement Leads Home is brought to you through the generous donations of Lisa DeGuardi, Richard Green, Ron Schooler, Kate Logan, Margaret Graves, and Gretchen Adams. And as always, thanks to Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right fit for your future. We are a listener-supported podcast, and we keep this going by your generous financial donations. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please head over to thewayofimprovement.com and click support. Or go directly to our Patreon page at patreon.com/thewayofimprovement. The best way to spread the word about the podcast is to tell a friend. You can follow us at TWOILH Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. If you like an episode, give us a share or a retweet, and consider a positive review on iTunes and Stitcher. On November 16, 1793, Thomas Jefferson, the U.S. Secretary of State at the time, wrote a short letter to Eli Whitney, the inventor of the recently designed cotton gin. Patents for new inventions were granted through the secretary's office, and Jefferson wanted Whitney to know how impressed he was with this new device for cleaning cotton. Quote, "Your favor of October 15th enclosing a drawing of your cotton gin was received on the 6th of this month. The only requisite of the law now uncomplied with is the forwarding of a model, which being received, your patent may be out and delivered to your order immediately. As the state of Virginia, of which I am, carries on household manufacturers of cotton to a great extent, as I also do myself, and one of our great embarrassments is the cleaning the cotton of the seed, I feel a considerable interest in the success of your invention for family use. Permit me, therefore, to ask information from you on these points. Has the machine been thoroughly tried in the ginning of cotton, or is it as yet but a machine of theory? What quantity of cotton has it cleaned on an average of several days and worked by hand, and by how many hands? What will be the cost of one of them made to be worked by hand? Favorable answers to these questions would induce me to engage one of them to be forwarded to Richmond for me. Wishing to hear from you on the subject, I am, sir, your most obedient servant, Thomas Jefferson." Jefferson was excited about this new machine that removed the seeds from short staple cotton. When Eli Whitney took out his patent for the cotton gin, the Secretary of State is reported to have said that the cotton gin was, quote, "the most useful and important invention which had then been recorded in that office," unquote. Jefferson never owned a cotton gin, and while he experimented with cotton at Monticello, he was never able to grow the crop successfully. But Jefferson knew that the cotton gin would revolutionize agriculture in the South. The difficult work of manually removing seeds from cotton would no longer be necessary. More and more Southern farmers could now grow cotton, and as they planted this new crop, their labor needs would increase. In other words, Eli Whitney's cotton gin, a model of late 18th century innovation and agricultural improvement, would lead to the expansion of slavery in the United States. Cotton needed picking. The United States Constitution brought an end to the international slave trade in 1808, but slave trading between the states would remain legal until the ratification of the 13th Amendment in 1865. As farmers living in the states in the Upper South began moving from the cultivation of tobacco to the cultivation of grain, they no longer needed as many slaves. They downsized their workforce by selling slaves to cotton growers in the so-called Deep South. This domestic slave trade has been described by historian Henry Louis Gates as the Second Middle Passage. In the early 19th century, about 1 million slaves were sold to plantations in Georgia, Alabama, Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Texas. And sometimes free Americans, kidnapped in the North, were sold as slaves in this region. This is where historian Richard Bell's story begins. Richard Bell teaches early American history at the University of Maryland. He has received several teaching prizes and major research fellowships, including the National Endowment for the Humanities Public Scholar Award. His first book, We Shall Be No More, Suicide and Self-Government in the Newly United States, was published in 2012 with Harvard University Press. His current book, Stolen, Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home, was published this year with Simon & Schuster. Welcome to the podcast, Richard.
John, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Great. Let's begin with a sort of general overview of, you know, what the story, you know, behind this book. I don't want you to give too much away because, you know, there is an ending here, right? But as much as you can talk about this, you know, why don't you set the context? Tell us a little bit about just the sort of general narrative flow of Stolen.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a true story, to be clear. And it took place it began in Philadelphia in 1825. It began with an offer and it began with a lie. It began when a man, a stranger, sidled up to a boy who was about 15 years old and offered him work, a couple of hours work, an odd job, coming with him to retrieve some crates filled with watermelons and peaches from a little ship bobbing down in the Delaware River just outside Philadelphia. The man said he needed help unloading the crates, and the boy he requested to help him was desperate for money, desperate for an odd job, desperate for the 25 cents this job would pay for a couple of hours' work, desperate to buy food, desperate to buy breakfast, dinner, lunch with that money. And the boy, who was African-American, followed this guy out of town and onto the ship. And there he found no peaches, no watermelons, no fruit of any kind. And he realized at that moment that he had just walked onto a ship then from which he might not be able to escape, that in fact he'd been kidnapped by one member of what turns out to be the United States' most fearsome gang of kidnappers and human traffickers in the 19th century, a gang who makes their living stealing free black children from the streets of northern free cities like Philadelphia and smuggling them halfway across the country to try to sell into slavery in the Deep South, in one or other of the new territories and states rising up along the Gulf Coast in the early 19th century. And kidnapping and human trafficking, it turns out, was big business. And this boy, Sam, is one of five boys kidnapped in the course of about 24 hours over a single day or two in late August 1825 by members of this gang of kidnappers and traffickers. And soon enough, they are shipping out from Philadelphia. They briefly weigh anchor on the eastern shore of Maryland, close to the Delaware line. They cross the Chesapeake Bay. They arrive in Norfolk, Virginia. Their kidnappers walk these five boys halfway across the continent through Virginia, through Tennessee, through Alabama and Mississippi with the hopes and intention of trying to sell them as slaves. That's a monstrous and long journey. It takes many months. It's a journey of 2 million steps. And this is how the beginning of my book, Stolen, begins, in a way that was familiar to many free Black adults and free Black children who themselves were also kidnapped and traded into slavery in the early 19th century, usually never to be heard from again.
Yeah, and you call this crime ring, this trafficking ring, you refer to this as the reverse Underground Railroad. This will be a phrase that's probably not familiar to many of our listeners. What was the reverse Underground Railroad? In some ways, you just described it, right? But how prevalent was this kind of these kidnapping rings, so forth? Obviously, reverse Underground Railroad is sort of playing on the Underground Railroad, right? That's so much in popular culture today with movies like Harriet and other things. But tell us a little bit more about this reverse Underground Railroad in the early 19th century.
Yes, thanks, John. So one of the things that startled me as I began this research project, which was back in 2011, I've been at this for a while, these things sometimes take time, was actually just how common things like this were. When I began this project, I knew of Solomon Northup's famous memoir, 12 Years right. a Slave, and I'm sure many of your listeners have heard that phrase and hopefully have seen the great movie that came out in 2013, which won the Academy Award. Right. For Best Picture. Solomon Northup was a victim of enslavement and human trafficking and kidnapping. He was a rider, a forced prisoner passenger on what I call the reverse Underground Railroad. And when I began research for this book, Stolen, which just came out, I had assumed that Northup was unusual, yeah. that what happened to him was anomalous, an outlier, one of the weird stories at the fringes of the history of American slavery that we all study in high school. But in fact, what happened to Northup was in many ways representative of what happened to so many other free Black adults and children. And in the course of 6 years of research, I turned up hundreds, if not thousands, of individual cases Wow. of free Black children, most especially, but also adults too, kidnapped from free cities and states, not just Philadelphia, but also New York, Boston, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, you name it. Kidnapped into American slavery with the hopes that they'll be transported across the continent and sold to planters in places where there is skyrocketing demand for enslaved labor. Now, we don't have accurate numbers, precise numbers, John, as to how many people were kidnapped by these criminal gangs. And there were dozens and dozens and dozens of these criminal gangs, in the same way that we don't have accurate information about the absolute number of people who escaped slavery on the Underground Railroad. Right. But in both cases, the sources that we do have, which are spotty and full of holes, suggest that the magnitude of both railroads, the good one and the grotesque one, was enormous, and that all told, probably tens of thousands of people either escaped slavery on the Underground Railroad in the 19th century or were sucked into it mm-hmm. by kidnappers and human traffickers on this thing I call the reverse Underground Railroad. Tens of thousands yeah. of people between, say, 1805 and 1855. It's a monstrous figure.
Now, this phrase, the reverse Underground Railroad, is that your term? Has it been used by other historians who study this period? I'm just curious.
It's an important question. You can Google this phrase, reverse Underground Railroad, and you'll find it has a Wikipedia page, and that Wikipedia page does not mention my research at this point.
There you go, listeners. Get his book in there. Yeah.
But what that tells us, John, is this term predates my book, Stolen. It's okay. a term that's circulated on the internet for some years, though it's not a term, reverse Underground Railroad, that has gained much traction among professional yeah. historians, among academic historians, let's say. Which is not to say that this phenomenon of kidnapping and trafficking into slavery was unknown to historians.
Right.
I may not have known much about it when I began this journey, but there are a couple of good scholarly articles about this, which usually use slightly different names. They don't call it the reverse Underground Railroad, but I can think of one scholar who calls it the other Underground Railroad. Okay. So this sort of term has been in the ether for a while, and I think it's useful. I think that yeah. while sometimes it flattens what's distinctive and peculiar about both railroads, the good one and the bad one, I also think the comparison is provocative and makes us think yeah. about scale and subterfuge and the similarities of routes and people traveling in different directions for very different purposes.
Yeah, I thought it was perfect, actually. I connected with the term right away. Someone who had not, you know, I don't study this period closely, so I had never heard the term before. So for me, it's a wonderful term, and it really captures what you're trying to do. Richard, tell me a little bit about you as the historian and your relationship with this project. How did you come across this story? And then how did you sort of piece this narrative together? I mean, you mentioned going to dozens of archives. Much of your research here is in, you know, at least for the layperson, sort of obscure records that most people don't look at, you know, in their kind of everyday historical research. Tell us a little bit about, you know, how you as the historian pieced this whole narrative together.
Thank you for that. Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there, and I hope I don't go on too long. I'll try to say two different things, but each one may take me a little while.
Sure.
The first one is to say how I came to this story, and then the second one is how did I try to execute it in the archives.
Right.
The first one, my previous book was an academic book. It was about suicide between the Revolution and the Civil War, written for graduate students, for faculty, not exactly a bestseller given the subject matter either.
I hear you. I've been there, yeah.
Yeah, we've all been there, right? And as you know from your own work, John, when your friends and colleagues know what you're working on, they will try to help you,
right,
and they will send you stuff that they think is relevant to your research. And that's often a godsend. And back when I was wrapping up my suicide book, a friend of mine sent me a link to an 1829 newspaper. I think it was the Delaware newspaper. And it told the true story, the news story, of a woman named Patty Cannon, who seemed to have committed suicide in a jail in rural Delaware in 1829, while she was awaiting trial for alleged murder, three people whose human remains had been discovered on property that she owned. I had never heard of Patty Cannon. I came to her story because she may or may not have committed suicide at the end of her life. It turns out likely that she didn't, that she likely died of natural causes, but the circumstances were suspicious, let's say. And as I began digging into her death, I found that her death was the least significant fact of her life, because Patty Cannon had spent much of her adult life as one of the leading kidnappers and human traffickers. She was actually the co-leader of the gang that kidnapped the five boys whose experiences are at the heart of this new book, Stolen. And the boys' names, by the way, are Sam, Cornelius, Alex, Enos, and Joe. So Patty Cannon's career, if you can call it that, at the heart of one of these grotesque kidnapping operations was something I was not ready for when I stumbled across her. And I went down the research rabbit hole, which is familiar to so many historians. You get obsessed by something, you become a detective, and you start to behave like Sherlock Holmes, like someone who thinks they're Sherlock Holmes. And so I started to work on her and soon put aside the idea of writing a biography of her, because I just couldn't stomach her for very long periods of time. But instead came to embrace this particular story of one kidnapping episode of many that she was involved in, where her gang lures away these five free black boys from the streets of Philadelphia in August 1825 and sends them on this journey into slavery, a journey that normally does not have a happy ending. Though in this case, this story takes some very unexpected turns. And if you remember the full title of my book, John, it's Stolen: Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. I don't want to say too much about the Astonishing Odyssey Home or the how and the why of what happened there, though it is genuinely, to me, astonishing and requires half a book to explain what the hell happened there. Excuse my language.
Sure. You mentioned she was involved in many of these kidnappings. Did you choose the story of these five boys because that was the easiest one for you to construct? And then are there other similar stories out there that, you know, there's enough information for historians to construct?
Yeah, so to be clear, there are hundreds, dozens, thousands, choose your metric, of stories like this waiting to be written about and addressed by historians.
Yeah.
And readers of my book Stolen will find me referring and drawing on those other cases quite frequently to fill in some of the gaps and the evidentiary holes I have with this story.
Right.
But as you pointed out, there are actually more records about this particular kidnapping case than normally are created when so many other free black children and adults went missing. This case is unusual in the body of records it produces, in the same way Solomon Northup's case is unusual in the memoir it produced. Normally, these children, these adults, are never heard from again. They don't leave big traces in trial transcripts, in police files. Most mayors and magistrates in northern cities are remarkably indifferent and apathetic to the disappearances of free black constituents of theirs in the 19th century, which is a reminder that, you know, to be free in a northern city, to have legal freedom, is very different from being treated equally or enjoying racial justice in a city like Philadelphia in the 19th century. But you had asked about how I went about executing this story.
Tell us about this detective work.
Easy is definitely not something it was.
Yeah.
As you know from your own historical research is incredibly frustrating most of the time.
Right.
With all the time and energy in the world, we can still have many, many frustrating days in the archive when we find absolutely nothing at all that moves the ball forward, that illuminates anything. And I spent 6 years in the archives. I think in my book, I counted up how many archives, and it was 35 archives
That's
in
right.
14 different states and the District of Columbia. And I was looking for needles in haystacks pretty much everywhere because historians who'd looked at this case before had really only ever come across two main sources before. One was a batch of letters about the case, which are on deposit at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, which to people who work in my field are well known.
Right.
And another is a couple of news stories in one anti-slavery magazine called The African Observer, which again, to people in my field are well known. But on their own, those two sources are not nearly plentiful or rich enough to reconstruct every aspect of this incredibly complicated and important and mind-bending case. And so I had to go looking for other sources. And in the course of 6 years, John, I think I came across more than 100 new sources that people really hadn't come across or stumbled across in the past. And I had a lot of help finding them, to be clear. And three of those I'll just highlight for your listeners as examples. One was the handwritten letter by one of the kidnappers explaining to a third party what exactly had happened and then denying all responsibility for it, which was a very curious thing to find. And the context for why he was writing is hugely important in explaining why that letter exists and how I found it. I also found with the help of some other historians, I found the handwritten notes of a trial transcript in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, that would determine the fate of one of the five boys forever. Would he be forever a slave or would he be forever free? This trial transcript, which we discovered, illuminated that. A third source I just draw attention to, and it's on page 8 in the book if you want to read it, it's the missing persons ad that one of the boy's father, boy who went missing, his name is Cornelius Sinclair. He was 10 years old. He's one of the five boys.
Right.
His father, Joseph Sinclair, places a missing persons ad, I think 3 days later after his son goes missing. It's immensely evocative, not just of what Cornelius, his missing son, looked like, which fills in important gaps for the historian, but also what his parents were going through after their only son disappeared.
I seem to recall, without giving too much away, I see this ad also plays a kind of secondary role in the narrative, right? When someone needs to identify Cornelius as the person who was kidnapped. Am I remembering that correctly?
You're absolutely right.
Right. So your story starts in Philadelphia. And you talk about, again, these are all free African-American boys who are part of this African-American community in Philadelphia. Tell us a little bit about that community. Slavery there, was it largely a free African-American community? What was sort of everyday life like for these boys and their families in early 19th century Philadelphia?
Yeah, such a rich question, right, with lots of answers we could respond with. So let's try and keep it as simple as possible, which is to say that by 1825, when the events in Stolen take place, Philadelphia is basically a free city and basically a free state. Now, in the colonial period, there had been slavery in Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia. Even some Quakers had owned slaves at certain times in that faith's history. It's only after the American Revolution, and in Pennsylvania, the key date is 1780, that legislators there begin to take action against race slavery, as many northern states do after the revolution, though oftentimes this action is very, very gradual. Pennsylvania passes something called a Gradual Abolition Act, which does abolish slavery in Pennsylvania, but takes about 40 years to do its work. It's an amazing and compromised story, and it's not one with many heroes in it. Yeah. But nevertheless, by 1825, when the events in Stolen take place, Philadelphia is a free city in a free state, though to its south, of course, there are several slave states, Delaware, Virginia, Maryland, to name the obvious three. So because Philadelphia is a free city by 1825, it has a significant free black population. Some of those people were freed under the terms of the Gradual Abolition Act over the previous 40 years, or are the descendants of people who were. Others are runaway slaves from neighboring slave states who come into Pennsylvania and into Philadelphia more generally, seeking refuge from slavery, believing that Philadelphia is free soil, which it basically is. And so by 1820 or so, when the last census takes place before my book, there are about, 12,000 free black people in Philadelphia, which is a very large number. In fact, only Baltimore has as many free black people at the same time. This is a very rich, large, and dynamic free black community, and they do enjoy legal freedom. However, as I said in response to one of your earlier questions, John, legal freedom is pretty much all they enjoy. The city is deeply racially divided, racially segregated. Racial tensions structure every encounter between a black person and a white person in the city of brotherly love. There is huge competition in the labor market, which results in a lot of racial discrimination against black job applicants. Free black people, husbands and wives, mothers and fathers, really struggle to get gainful employment in that racially divided job market. The housing market is equally racially divided, and there are plenty of white folks who will quite happily tell you, if you ask them, that they'd rather these free black people were not here. Right. They'd rather they were somewhere else, maybe back in slavery, or maybe in Liberia, or Sierra Leone, or Haiti, or wherever it might be. So the racial climate is actually quite toxic, and so free black people have to work really hard to build something vibrant and dynamic and beautiful in that context, and they do that through the creation of free black churches, free black mutual societies, free black schools. They are doing everything they can to live and thrive, but it's a very difficult place to be free and black.
How old were these boys and what were they doing down at the docks?
They're a good representation of these larger forces we've just talked about. Right. So five boys, I'm going to separate them into two groups. In one group, I'll put four of the boys who were all born to legally free black parents in Philadelphia. And their names are Cornelius, Enos, Alex, and Joe. Two of them are chimney sweeps, which is a job that contributes to their family's family budget. And their parents are certainly glad that they can that their children could find work. Though being a chimney sweep in Philadelphia is to be engaged in one of the dirtiest, most dangerous, and I think deadliest jobs a child could have as a teenager or younger in Philadelphia. There's nothing glamorous or funny about chimney sweeps. We tend to think of Mary Poppins and Dick Van Dyke and Lin-Manuel Miranda in the remake, but there's nothing chirpy and fun about being exposed to lung cancer or being covered in soot every day. This was jobs that white kids and white parents would not do themselves. And so this was jobs for black folk who would get extremely dirty and lung clogged doing this work. People called them lily whites to make fun of them because they were obviously not white in either sense. So two of the four boys are chimney sweeps. Another of the boys has a couple of years of schooling under his belt. He's been a good student. And another boy makes mats for a living. He's an apprentice to a mat maker. The fifth boy is different from the others. I call him free because he's run away from slavery. He ran away from slavery 7 days before he's kidnapped into slavery. This is Sam. He's 15 years old. Your listeners may be wondering which slave state he ran away from, and it's not going to be probably their first pick. He's not a runaway from slavery in Maryland. He's not a runaway from slavery in Virginia or from Delaware or anywhere further south. He's a runaway from slavery in New Jersey, which is actually to the north and the east of Philadelphia. This is a reminder that while most northern states had slowly dismantled race slavery by the 1820s, New Jersey is the laggard and is still very much in the throes of that process. And there is still plantation slavery of a certain kind in West Jersey in the 1820s. And Sam is caught up in it. Sam decides to run away from his master when his master begins giving signs that he might try to sell Sam to someone in Georgia, different type of slavery that Sam wanted nothing to do with. So Sam runs. In the week before he is kidnapped in Philadelphia, he runs away from slavery, away from New Jersey, 50 miles south into Philadelphia, hoping to take refuge in what he knows to be this large, free, and dynamic black community. But he knows no one, and he finds it very difficult to get by in those first 7 days. He struggles for a place to sleep. We think he's homeless those first 7 nights. We know he struggles for food and for income those first 7 nights. And so when a stranger offers him 25 cents to help offload some peaches and watermelons, the same deal that the stranger offers to Cornelius, to Enos, to Alex and Joe, Sam leaps at the chance to earn some money quickly and get enough money for 3 meals.
And then the story kind of goes on from there, and he's kidnapped, and I think he's the last one, right, to be kidnapped. So he meets the other 4 boys in the ship.
Yes. 2 of these boys have known each other from a brief interaction they've had at school. 2 of the boys are both chimney sweeps and probably knew each other through that occupation. But in general, these 5 boys do not know each other at all or very well. Yeah. And they are thrown together in the belly of this little ship where supposedly the peaches and watermelons are, right, but which there are none. And after that begins a long, brutalizing journey across the country.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Well, not necessarily about that journey, but they're taken down to what I'm guessing is the kind of headquarters of this trafficking ring on the Delmarva Peninsula on the border of Maryland and Delaware. They're taken to Norfolk, Virginia, and they travel into the interior of the United States. You know, this is just such a kind of, I don't know if sophisticated is the right word, but this is an operation, right? These kidnappers actually have a own property and have cabin or a house in Asheville, Alabama. So they make it there. You can read the account to see, you know, what the journey is like. And something that struck me, and maybe our listeners too, you don't really think about this with kind of this internal slave trade or this domestic slave trade, or in this case, this kind of reverse underground railroad, which really isn't even as much the slave trade as it is kind of a kidnapping ring. Yes. But they begin to prepare the slaves in Asheville, Alabama for market. And this takes some time, and it's you know, very tragic, and it's a rough story to kind of think about. But it was an essential part of the work of these kidnappers. They needed to get these slaves in shape or prepare them for sale. I think they want to sell them in Natchez, right? Mississippi. What does all this entail? Describe what's going on this piece of property in this cabin in Asheville, Alabama, as these kidnappers begin to prepare these slaves for sale.
Yes, thank you. It's so important to recover this experience.
Right.
And one piece of context I think listeners may need to understand the economic context of the day. You mentioned this thing called the domestic slave trade.
Right.
You also called it the internal slave trade.
Right.
And historians use both terms interchangeably. So the context here is that in 1808, the U.S. government outlaws further American participation in the transatlantic slave trade.
Right.
Anyone who now wants to buy slaves within the United States and do so lawfully has to buy them from someone who already has slaves in the United States. And because most slaves in the 1800s, 1810s are still concentrated on the East Coast, especially in the Upper South, in places like Virginia and Maryland. And because most people who want to buy slaves are swarming into Alabama, Mississippi,
right,
Louisiana in this same period, what we see is that the rise of this domestic market, a wholly legal domestic slave trade, where slave owners in places like Maryland, where I live now, sell a proportion of their slaves, who they believe are surplus to their own requirements, to legal slave traders, who carry them across or around the country to Natchez or New Orleans, jack up the prices and resell them to new planters setting up farming cotton or sugar in the Gulf Coast. And that's a wholly legal phenomenon, and it's massive. And historians, including Ed Baptist and others, and Michael Tadman, have estimated that 1 million slaves are legally traded from places like the Upper South to places like the Lower South between about 1790 and 1860. That's a massive forced migration. But planters down in the Deep South want still more. And the more they're willing to pay, the more tempting and profitable it becomes for anyone sufficiently cold-blooded to kidnap free black people from northern states, smuggle them into this larger and legal domestic supply chain, and try to pass them off as legally purchased slaves when they're sold in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. So that's the context here,
right,
John, which is hugely important to explain why kidnapping is so virulent, so prevalent, so monstrously frequent.
Yeah.
And a big part of that effort to disguise kidnapped free people as legally purchased slaves and smuggle them into the supply chain takes place at one way station or other, one safe house or other, one hut or other in the Deep South before the captives are put up for sale. And in the case of the five boys in Stolen, this new book, this gang operates a safe house, a cabin in a tiny, tiny place called Asheville, Alabama, not to be confused with Asheville, North Carolina.
Right. These are almost like the safe houses, right? If you want to call them that, in the Underground Railroad, right?
Yes. Yeah, a mirror, an inversion, a sort of funhouse mirror.
Yeah.
Opposite. And the motives, of course, the wildly
different.
Of course. But yes, both networks use safe houses. So at these safe houses, like the one in Asheville that this gang operates, their goal is to fatten up these people who've been walking and walking and walking on minimum rations for months now, and who often look like ragged colts, right, or skeletons. So to fatten them up and make them look healthy, to dress them up in fancy clothes, to make them give off the whiff of being a lifestyle investment for future buyers. These captors even wash these children's hair. And we know of other kidnappers who braid children's hair and put ribbons in them to make them look soft and fancy and genteel. This is horrible work. It's also intimate work. And for captors of kidnapped free people, they also have the extra task of trying to drill these children to forget that they are free, to suppress their identities as kidnapped free children, and to take on or internalize new origins stories, new identities that, no, you are not Solomon Northup living in upstate New York. You are now Platt, and you were bought in Washington legally.
Right.
This is actually what happens to Solomon Northup.
Yeah.
And the same is what happens to these boys. They are drilled to recite new identities, to never reveal to any potential buyer that they're legally free and that they've been kidnapped. And of course, if they don't, then the threat of violence is ever present among their captors. And normally this is the end of it. Normally this is a terrifyingly effective way to disguise this heinous crime and make a sale and then do a runner before your buyer finds out that he or she has been hoodwinked. Or maybe your buyer doesn't care. But in this case, one of the boys, and this is perhaps all I'll say about this, John, to your, to your listeners, one of the boys forgets his role, by which I mean he chooses to speak up to the potential buyer and says, I am Sam, I am free, I was kidnapped in Philadelphia, so were these other boys, you must do something. And wildly, unexpectedly, almost unfathomably, the Mississippi slave owner to whom he is about to be sold listens carefully.
Right. Our time's about up, but that leads me to the final question I want to ask you. And it's some, a little bit of a kind of metaphysical question too, right? This book is filled with fascinating characters. You have, of course, the boys. There are two adult women who also travel with them. I can't remember. Are they kidnapped?
One is kidnapped. Yeah. One is legally purchased.
That's right. There are some characters in here that I would describe as evil. We see people, a lot of people who are doing good in this book, but they're doing good for kind of selfish motives, you know, to benefit their own ambitions. And then we see characters that, at least on the surface, or as you describe them, I don't see any reason to argue not, they act in the moment out of this kind of selflessness. They show a certain degree of courage and moral fortitude. I'm not talking just about the boys here. I'm talking about those who enter into the story. There's a darkness in this book, but there's also, I left this book also with a great deal of hope because of certain characters within it. I don't know if you could talk about this. You've lived with these characters for 6+ years, right? You've met them along the way. Talk about your engagement with such a vast array of characters. Did you come away depressed, you know, talking about the injustice of the kidnapping? But is it fair to say that there's some hope in this book as well?
I think that's a really smart point, John. And I couldn't have written this story and stayed with these characters, these real people, for this long had things gone the way things normally went when so many other free Black children, adults were sucked into Southern slavery by kidnappers like this gang. But as we've both talked about, unusual things happen in this story, and they happen for two reasons. Number one is because there are some people in positions of political power who are white, who decide to give a damn,
yeah,
to get off the sidelines and do something here and to do good things for people that need their help. An elder and a minister in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, who do the right thing,
right,
at considerable cost to their reputations and livelihoods as salaried members of a church in a slave state. They put their necks out. There's also the mayor of Philadelphia, who, unlike all his predecessors and unlike most of his successors in that job, does something, gets off the sidelines in this particular case. And that man is of Quaker background, and the Quakers have a long and proud history in the anti-slavery fight, especially in the 19th
right
century. So that's the first thing gave me hope about writing this story and staying with it. But the other is something you mentioned, and I'll just go back and highlight, which is the actions of these boys and the actions of their
right
parents are phenomenally inspirational,
yeah,
here. And we know that lots of other children, lots of other parents tried to do the same things too. But in this particular case, it works by and large. And the pressure they put on their shaky white allies, the pressure they put on people who don't normally give a damn or get off the sidelines, makes all the difference here. And without the courage and heroism of these children,
right,
and their parents, who never lose sight of them, this story could have ended up very differently indeed.
It's so well written, Richard. I told you before we recorded that I read this book in one sitting. It takes you on this kind of emotional roller coaster, right? I can't imagine what it'd have been like to write it and to research it, but you're seeing the depths of depravity, right, in early 19th century America with these kidnappers, and that you're sort of inspired by these stories of, as you said, people who gave a damn, right? And I think that just makes for a wonderful story that we should all, as historians, kind of aspire to one day find a story like this and be able to tell it as well as you did. So thanks so much for taking the time, Richard. The book, again, is Stolen: Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. Get out there. It makes a great holiday gift for those of you who are looking for something to buy for that history lover in your life. So thanks again, Richard.
It's been a pleasure, John. Thanks so much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this interview with Richard Bell. This is a fascinating book. If you like the movie 12 Years a Slave, you might really enjoy Stolen. And Bell writes so well. I'm so happy to have him on the program today. Again, this makes a great Christmas gift, I think, for the kind of lay historical reader in your family. So get out there and get a copy of Stolen. So again, thanks for listening. We'll be back with a few more episodes this season, so stay tuned. In the meantime, may your way of improvement always be home.
This has been a production of The Way of Improvement Leads Home, a blog dedicated to reflections at the intersection of American history, religion, politics, and academic life. Visit us at thewayofimprovement.com. The Way of Improvement Leads Home is a member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. Check out the other podcasts on the network by heading over to recordedhistory.net. If you want to support our efforts, please rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice so others may more easily find this podcast. And let's continue the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us at TWOILH Podcast. The podcast is brought to you through the generous support of Gretchen Adams, Richard Green, Margaret Graves, Kate Logan, Lisa DeGuardi, and Ron Schooler. Also, many thanks to our sponsor, Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. The podcast was recorded at the High Center Studios of Messiah College. Thanks to Ed Ark for his continued support. Original music is by Overholt. Many thanks to our guest, Richard Bell. Our studio producer is Casey Lehman. I've been your producer, Drew Dearly Hermeling. And your host is John Fia.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.